My ex-partner knew I was about to leave, but I still needed a couple of weeks to furnish my new apartment and move. He seemed to accept it. Then one night, he provoked a fight with our 3-year-old, yelled at him until he cried, and then locked him in his room. I wanted to go to him, but it was a trap. My ex blocked me and kicked me out of the apartment. I called the police, and they told me to do as he tells me, or they cannot guarantee my safety. Of course, I don't get that in writing, so the official version will be that I decided to leave our child out of my own free will. In the following days, I went to the police, the Child Protection Services, tried to get my empty place ready, even though I had to leave all my belongings behind, struggled with chicken pox, consulted with lawyers, booked therapy sessions for me and my son, and went on with my day job. My ex sabotaged everything I did. Even though I still did almost all childcare, and he got to decide when he spends time with our son. I didn't get much help during this period. I had to do whatever he wanted to avoid escalation. A few months later, my ex casually revealed that all he had to do was change his administrative status to single, and he was automatically assumed to be sole custodian with all the tax and other benefits. And on top of everything, he was offered free consultations with a therapist to help him deal with the separation. Hi, I'm Zahn Velines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about coercive control, post-separation abuse, and what happens to women and children in the family courts. Before we get started, as always, I have a couple of administrative reminders. The Liberating Motherhood website has a cornucopia of information about my work and this podcast, including details on how to appear on the podcast, how to submit a story for the podcast, how to ask an advice question, how to contact me, so much more. Check it out at liberatingmotherhood.org. And also, as most of us know, social media algorithms are actively working to suppress feminist voices. We've seen it in women being banned from Facebook and then being pushed down in the algorithms. And this has a really significant speech effect. Because most people decide what they're going to watch, what they're going to listen to, and what they're going to read based on what the algorithm serves up to them. So it's really important that we show these algorithms that we like and want feminist content. The way that you can do this is by any kind of engagement, likes, comments, shares, reposts. With podcasts, it's especially important to leave positive reviews. Doing all of these things helps the podcast continue to grow. And it helps me continue to get great guests. It also helps push back on what social media algorithms are doing to feminist and leftist creators. So I hope if you like this podcast, you'll share it. Please consider leaving a positive review. And if you really like this podcast, you can become a paid subscriber. Paid subscribers get at least one bonus podcast episode a month. They get access to the Liberating Motherhood support group, and they get at least 8 additional essays a month. So that's a lot of stuff for basically the cost of a cup of coffee. You can subscribe at zahn.substack.com/subscribe. You can also give gifts to people at that address if you're already a subscriber. So I hope you'll consider it. Today, my guest is Elizabeth Delgarno. Elizabeth is a world-leading researcher and advocate in the field of abuse and advocacy for women and children, particularly identifying the effects of coercive control, institutional abuse, post-separation abuse, and family court on families. She has worked in public and private health and social care for over 20 years and specializes in challenging inequalities and systemic challenges in health and social care. Her work centers always around vulnerable and/or marginalized groups. She is a staunch advocate of co-designed, developed, and conducted research, where research is undertaken by and with the people it concerns rather than on them. She teaches global women's health and health system challenges in low and middle income countries through a complex adaptive system lens on the Masters in Public Health at the University of Manchester, amongst other roles, and has special interests in adult social care, the health and trauma impacts and experiences of women and children who are victim survivors of abuse, family court experiences and health impacts, gender-based violence, domestic abuse and violence, coercive control, and post-separation abuse. She provides training and consultation to schools, domestic abuse organizations, local authorities, health and social care services, and other interested groups. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So if you are new to Elizabeth and her work, she has an incredible Substack, and I'm struck by how much you cover. Your work is both broad and deep. You've written extensively about post-separation abuse, the family court system, courts of control. Yet so much of what you write about and so much of what is just common knowledge and second nature to you and to me and probably a lot of the listeners continues to not be well known in mainstream discourse. For example, when I tell people that men who have molested their children can still get custody, they literally do not believe me. So I thought maybe we could start by maybe you could share what you would like people who are new to this knowledge base and this system to know. What is the sort of surprising information that you think might change people's perspectives and orientations toward these issues?
Okay, so I guess if we start at a kind of socioeconomic level, there is, I think, a misconception about who is coming to family court. And most people think that this is just two warring parents who can't agree about child arrangements, so how much contact one parent should have with a child or where the child should live. And actually, globally, in all family court systems, what we know is that the majority of these cases are actually abuse cases. So people have that misconception to begin with. They think it's conflict, and it's not conflict. It's usually a victim and a survivor and a perpetrator. Now, it's not just the general public who have that misconception. It is the judiciary as well. The judiciary generally, not all of them, but generally tend to look at this former couple in front of them and think this is two people who can't get on. But as well as that, we have, as you know very well, in our society, very, very misogynistic, patriarchal structures. And so all the tropes that women are subjected to in everyday life. So, for example, we know that when a woman is raped, one of the first questions usually that people say is, well, what were you wearing? Or were you drunk? Or what were you doing? You know, they instantly victim blame the woman and they apply these misogynistic tropes to her. That same kind of thing happens in the family courts. So it's similar but slightly different. So straight away, when a mother presents, and it's usually mothers and children who are reporting abuse to the court, and they say, I don't want to have contact with this father. Again, not always fathers, but the majority of the time, I don't want to have contact with this father because he's abusive. The women very quickly get labelled as hysterical, you know, over-anxious, exaggerating, lying, manipulating. And again, there's no evidence for this whatsoever. This is all tropes that are applied to these women. Another misconception that people have about family court, I think, is that it's wealthy people. So a lot of people that seem to think this is always wealthy parents who've got more money than sense coming to court to resolve their dispute. Again, not true. So the majority of people globally in the family courts actually are some of the most live in some of the most deprived areas in the country where they live. So the other issue here is that it's not, again, it's not just the abuse that needs to be considered. It's the context around this family. So, you know, when we look into an individual relationship, so again, usually, not always, but usually, the sole financial lead, if you like, in the family is usually the father. So the person who has the most economic power in these relationships is usually the father. So again, that exacerbates the issues because so you've got a mum and a child presenting in the courts who are victims of abuse. They have less economic power. They've often been advised, as you described in the vignette, they've often been advised by child protection services to either just leave, go and find somewhere else to live, which they can't do because they don't have access to the economic means, they don't have the money to just get up and leave. Or they're told, stay with your partner. I say partner in inverted commas, stay with this man, and you should be actively seeking ways to protect your child. Now, in the UK, what we call it is how the failure to protect is a failure to protect. And what I mean by that is these systems say that to the mum, you're failing to protect your child. So they threaten child removal. So if mum doesn't just get up and leave, even though she's got possibly no money, no access, no support system, especially if she's being coercively controlled, which is the most common type of abuse as well. So if she's been isolated, she's got no support network, she can't just get up and leave. So at that point, what the system does, the child protection system, is threaten mum. So if you stay with this man, I'm going to remove your child and place that child into care. So what you will find is mums then do flee. They find a way sometimes, usually by going to a refuge or by another means. And then they find themselves in the private family courts. And this is where fathers then, the same fathers who the child protection system have just said to the mum, that dad is too unsafe to be around your child. Now, the same dad goes to the private court and says to the private judge, I want access to my child. And because the private judge, lives by all these misconceptions and misogynistic views of mothers, he tends to say, right, well, the dad seems fine to me. You might have evidenced abuse, but it's historic. They love to focus on abuse as being in the past. And you'll often hear a family court judge say, where's he at now? Where are we at now? Like there's some magic wand that's been waved, and this man who's been abusive for years and years and years has suddenly not become, learn to not abuse overnight with no support or intervention. And the judge usually says, the child can go and stay at dad's 2 or 3 nights a week, unsupervised. And if mum doesn't accept that, in my research in England and in Brazil, what then tends to happen is mum will get accused of alienation. So, if mum keeps advocating for her child and the child keeps saying, my dad's hurting me, I'm scared of him, I don't want to go there, the courts will say it's parental alienation, which essentially means the courts are saying mum's manipulated the child into making this up, and the abuse hasn't really happened. Now, if at this point mum keeps advocating for the child and the child keeps speaking up, then the private courts will threaten the mum and say, if you don't let this dad have contact with this child, we're going to take the child away from you, and that child will either go into care or the child will go and live with dad permanently. So you've got one system, the public system, saying, if you stay with this man, I'm going to take your child away. And you've got the private system saying, if you don't maintain contact with this man, I'm going to take your child away. So mums and children are stuck between a rock and a hard place. There's literally nothing they can do. I don't, sorry, I feel like I've gone off on a tangent there, so.
Oh, no, you haven't. I want to talk a little bit more about this parental alienation thing. And, I'm a little embarrassed to admit that before I myself became a mother, I was not really aware of all the misogyny that mothers face. I did know that dads typically don't do their fair share of parenting. And, I did identify as a feminist, but I had this idea that, well, the really feminist thing is for parents to have joint custody because, dads should participate in parenting. And I think a lot of people see this 50-50 custody, joint custody thing as like a progressive thing, as what's fair, as what's right, as what's just, when the reality is that for a lot of these men, having any custody at all puts the children in danger. And in the majority of these families, it's a huge disruption of the child's life because the dad has not even done 10% of the parenting, let alone 50%. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about this like joint custody presumption, why it's so harmful, and like the false ideology that it's built on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was exactly the same as you. Growing up, I always believed that, women and men, mums and dads should share the load, and that was the best thing for everyone. However, it goes back to the original point that I made. The majority of these families are victim and perpetrator families. So, in an ideal world, if you've got a mum and dad where there's no abuse, then as long as the child would be thriving with 50-50 custody, and as long as that's what the child was used to, as you say, did they always have that 50-50 primary carer structure? I would have no issues with that. The problem is the majority of these families, and not always again, but the majority of the time, there is a father who is a perpetrator of abuse who was never the primary carer, never showed any interest in the children other than to abuse them, and the mother. And now suddenly he wants 50-50 custody, because it's a way for him to further abuse and maintain control over the child and mother who have physically left his grasp by separating from him. So, in a perfect world, there's nothing wrong with 50-50 custody. The other thing is, in the majority of countries that are advocating for 50-50 custody, if you look at the history behind these legal statutes, they're based on no evidence at all. They tend to be based on lots of campaigns by fathers' rights groups, majority of them far right, fathers' rights groups, I should say, right wing, and very outdated views that women and children belong to fathers, are the property of men. That is actually how the courts were founded. So when the family courts were founded, women and children were deemed as the property of men. And it was only fairly recently that sort of view changed. So the issue around shared custody is an issue because the majority of cases that are in family court contain a victim of who's a mother and a perpetrator who's a father. And the core issue here is that the research, the actual evidence base, if you look into the evidence base as I have for quite some time now, what the evidence tells you is firstly, What matters to a child is stability and the stability of their primary carer. Okay, so if a child has been used to being with mum the majority of the time, and then suddenly the child is torn away from mum to be placed with father half of the week. Well, there's multiple problems there. You're tearing them away from the primary carer. You're making their life unstable. And the evidence shows us quite clearly and repeatedly what children need is at least one loving, nurturing, stable parent. Okay? What they do not need and what is bad for children is having two parents where one or more of them is abusive. So all of the science tells us what children need, but the courts don't listen to science. The courts rely on previous legal statutes. So what did previous judgments say about how or where a child should live? So it's really interesting and really damaging because what we see in the courts is basically decisions being made about children and their lives and how they're going to be impacted. All of that is based on opinion, essentially. This is what a previous judge's opinion was, so this is how I'm going to now make my opinion. It's not based on science.
I think that bit is so critical, and you've articulated it so well that this is all based on legal precedent, which is a historical artifact and goes back to the time again when women and children were viewed as property. And then the little bits that judges and that mediators and that other family court participants can fill in, they rely on stereotypes. And the thing that we see so often is the idea of the crazy woman. And it's so pernicious. And, men use it constantly. Oh, my ex was crazy. And it's like this thought terminating cliche that as soon as you say that, no further questioning is required. Talk to me about, I mean, to me, the idea that like women tend to be crazy is just absurd when we compare women's behavior as a group to men's behavior as a group. So, how did this idea of the crazy woman take hold, and how is it weaponized in family courts?
Oh gosh, how did it take hold? I think it goes back as far as on as Burn the Witch days, doesn't it? I don't think it ever went away from there, to be honest. If we really get into it here, I think there has to be a level of honesty about perhaps men's fear or feeling threatened by women's potential, not just as mothers, but the fact that women can create life. And that's where the witch trial started, wasn't it? Because what the men saw was these women who essentially were midwives, as you know, were saying, okay, look, I've got some ideas here about how I could help you with this birth. And if anything went remotely wrong, they were considered a witch and they were burned at the stake. And so I think this sort of suspicious attitude towards women has never gone away. And it's sort of still here now within the courts. And the worst thing for me is that the framework of parental alienation is essentially founded upon these misogynistic tropes. So this idea that this woman's an evil witch who has manipulated her child against this loving father. And this is why I always write about how if a child is truly being abused by any parent to a point where they are actively and wrongly being manipulated and turned against a loving parent, that would come under coercive control. Okay, so if a child is being made to feel over time and pressured and dominated and made to feel that something fearful will happen to them, some punishment will happen to them if they don't, if they go against the parent, in that situation, I would class that as coercive control. But the difference between coercive control and parental alienation is quite specific. So if I give you some examples, so for example, with parental alienation, right, they believe that those advocates believe that this relationship has stopped, was originally wonderful between the child and the dad, okay, because it's generally used against mums. So the alienationists believe the child had a wonderful, loving relationship with dad, and all the issues only began after the parental separation. Now, what you will find is when you look into that history, the history of the family, the mum can usually evidence that the child and mum have been abused for years and years and years. So it's not that they've just suddenly turned around for no reason and said to this wonderful father, we don't want to see you anymore. There will be a deep history of abusive behaviour. So while parental alienation alleges that this sudden change in the child began at the point of separation, coercive control would acknowledge that if there was serious abuse going on, it would have happened long before the relationship ended. Another thing about parental alienation is it obscures and diminishes, as I said at the beginning, the historical events that kind of lead to the child rejecting the parent. So because it says this is sudden and it's post-separation, it's obscuring all that previous detail. And CCB, so coercive control frameworks, they centre what is both historical and present, so what abuse is still happening now, and what risk might there be to the child if they maintain contact with this parent? The other thing to consider within all of this is that when a mum and a child say to the court, my child is being abused, right? Legally, it's on the mother to prove that abuse. So whoever raises the abuse, it's on them to prove that abuse is happening. Now, when they can't prove, and we know how hard it is, unless you've been diarising and monitoring and writing down every bit of your abuse for the last 10 to 15 years, well, how can you go about demonstrating that you've been coercively controlled? It's extremely difficult to do, which is why we advise people, keep diaries. But again, can you do that safely? How do you do that safely? But the point I'm getting at is in when a mother and a child cannot prove that they've been abused, the court then turns the fact that they even reported abuse into an indicator of harm. So they badge the mum and child's disclosure as harmful, as emotional harm. That is a huge leap to take, and that is when you see the courts turn and they start going down the road of false allegations and these false allegations, which again is fed into by, oh gosh, there's such a huge history here, Zorn, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. But if we talk some more about the history and where did all this come from, it came from the false memory movement. So the false memory movement I don't want to talk in too much depth, but in a very brief nutshell, there is a wonderful professor who I'm sure you've heard of called Jennifer Fried. And she's written about this publicly, so I'm not breaching any confidence. She was abused by her parents. And when she reported that, she was abused as a child. And when she reported that, her mum and dad founded in response the false memory movement. Okay, so essentially, to deny their child's allegations, they said, "Oh, she's got false memories." Now, the false memory movement has been harnessed by Jeffrey Epstein, and in fact, one of the most prolific false memory activists, advocates, whatever you wish to call them, was called upon in Epstein's original trial by Ghislaine Maxwell's team. Okay, so this is massive. The tentacles of this awful, awful movement are huge. Now, from the false memory movement came Dr. Richard Gardner, and he then developed parental alienation syndrome. So the idea that, again, mums planted these false memories into the child's mind, or otherwise convince the child that they've been abused when they haven't been. So it all comes from the same extremely murky background. And if you look deep into Richard Gardner's work, if you can stomach it, he writes in his books about how children seduce their fathers. It's natural to be a paedophile, and it's good for evolution. These are things he says in his books. And the fact he said all these things is sickening. You know, let's be real. But what he was doing there was founding a theory that then exploded into a very lucrative industry that could be used to say, mum is crazy, the child's been brainwashed. And you know, the tentacles to this are so far-reaching, it is so dark. But another tentacle of this is Richard Gardner was the psychiatrist called into Mia Farrow, her private law case. So Mia Farrow is Woody Allen's ex-wife, as you may well know, and their daughter reported that her dad, Woody Allen, was sexually abusing her. So he got in Richard Gardner to defend dad and say that Mia Farrow had brainwashed her daughter. Now, Mia Farrow's daughter stands by those claims to this day, and she's an adult woman, and you can Google all of this. And you can watch some fantastic videos. Richard Gardner also testified for Michael Jackson against the children who disclosed about Michael Jackson. So it's not just that these myths and tropes in society have been harnessed. The theories have been built on these myths and tropes. And they feed back into the myths and tropes. And until we get rid of these myths and tropes and these misogynistic and pseudoscientific fake science theories, we're going to keep seeing this happen to women because they are the ultimate weapons of the patriarchy. She's mad, bad, crazy. She's making it up. She's manipulative, you know. It's so easy for people to buy into because they're so used to hearing those tropes. It's awful.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point is that this isn't an accident, that these ideas were invented for a reason, and the deliberate purpose is oppressing and controlling women and by extension, children. So I want to switch gears a little bit to talk about something that, you know, you've written and talked about a little bit, and that I have too, that I think can be challenging to talk about in advocacy spaces, which is that Abused women do not typically act like perfect victims, and they often do not act like what we think they should act like. And I remember when I first started working with victim survivors, I'm ashamed to admit now, but I think it's also important to admit so that other people can kind of understand how these things go. I would get really frustrated and angry with them because what would happen is they would not be able to give, I'll give some examples. They would not be able to give a succinct statement about the abuse. They'd talk around the issue. Rather than saying, my husband punched me in the face, they'd say, I got hurt during an argument. Rather than saying their husband was a child molester, they'd say, well, some bad things happened. They'd also often look for reasons that their husband meant well. It was just an accident. He's so nice. Not because they wanted to be abused or they wanted their children to be abused, but because accepting that this person doesn't love you and wants to hurt you is incredibly hard and painful. They would often make decisions that undermined them in court. They'd go back to their abuser, or they would, give an excuse for the abuser. They'd bake an excuse for the abuser into what they said to the court, like, well, our child is really difficult. And I found this so frustrating. And what I realized over time is that these behaviors are actually symptoms of the abuse, but in court, we treat them as evidence that the abuse is not happening. Can you talk a little about that?
Absolutely. So I'm rereading Don Hennessy at the moment. I don't know if you've read his work. He's absolutely wonderful. And he's worked with perpetrators and victim survivors for many, many years. And what he talks about is it about how these perpetrators get into the minds of victims. So one thing he says quite prominently all the time is that the reason we can't stop abuse is because the language of abuse is controlled and dominated by the perpetrator. So as you've just said, Zorn, these women have been controlled and manipulated for so many years into not just being abused, but into questioning their own behavior, controlled into believing that he only was violent because he was drunk or because she didn't make the tea on time or. These are all reasons and language that the perpetrator has given to her. And she's got so used to, embedding that into her own narrative, her own internal narrative of herself and the relationship. And also, as I've written about, most victims believe they are in a genuinely loving relationship. And most victims don't know they're being abused, especially say for younger women who sorry, for women who got into an abusive relationship when they were younger. If you haven't known any other type of relationship, and if how do you know that you're being abused? How do you have the language to describe that? And it's really, really important that you don't sort of disempower women and tell them how to feel about things that have happened or tell them what they should believe. But at the same time, as long as we keep using the language of the perpetrators and focusing on how abuse is described by perpetrators and by proxy victim survivors who have used that language because that's what they're used to, we'll never get to be able to challenge it. So it's really, really difficult. Something else Don Hennessy talks about a lot is, again, these ideas of myths and tropes, and I want to take a slightly different angle here to what I was saying before. So it's not just negative tropes about women, it's the positives as well. So I say positive tropes, but okay, less negative tropes, if you like. So gendered expectations. So in one of his chapters, he talks about how a father justified to the family court judge that he hit his wife because he'd been to work for 12 hours, and when he got home, his supper wasn't on the table. And that was her role. That's what he told the court. My role is to work, hers is to make sure that the tea's on the table, and she didn't do that. That won him custody of the children, because the judge thought, well, that's a reasonable expectation by the father. So this gendered expectation of the mother lost her children. So this is what I talk about when I say anything a woman does is used against her. There is no perfect victim. You're either too fat, too thin, too ugly, too intelligent, too white, too brown. There is always a reason for people to hate on women. And this might be uncomfortable for a lot of people, but some of the most misogynistic people I've ever met have been women. And this is the grand trap, isn't it? The grand trap of the patriarchy, that they've managed to play us all off against each other out of self-protection, out of competition, out of safety. Whatever the reasons, they've managed to play us all off against each other. And some of the worst judges I've come across have been female judges as well. And I always quote this study called the Gender Social Norm Index, right? And this is a global study, and it's done every few years on hundreds of countries across the world. And every single time they do this study, they find the same thing from thousands and thousands of people across the world, that 9 out of every 10 men and women are biased against women. That is misogyny at a global scale. How do we get to grips with that? And until we do get to grips with that, how are we going to let women speak, and more importantly, hear them when they do speak without judging them?
Yeah, absolutely. So something I was digging through your Substack today, and I was heartened to see that you're writing a lot about child sexual abuse. And I think probably like most people, for most of my life, I knew that rape was common and that sexual violence was common. But I thought that pedophilia was fairly uncommon, more common than people are willing to admit, but that, like if I went out in a day, I was unlikely to encounter a pedophile. But what I've encountered in recent years in my work with women is a stunning number who married men who are, in fact, pedophiles, who are caught looking at child sexual assault material, who molest their children, who admit to pedophilic beliefs. And the research supports that, these women aren't outliers. There was a study that just came out that found that 1 in 6 Australian men to being attracted to children. And, you've been writing about and doing the research on this, and I just wonder if you could speak a little bit about how common that really is and the myth that it's, deranged lunatics that we would just immediately notice.
Yeah, it's really, really common. And so, for example, if we think about the UK, right? So, in that study you've just referenced, they estimated that 840,000 predominantly males pose some degree of sexual risk to children just in the UK. So that's nearly, a million male predators, child predators, walking amongst us. Now, again, in the UK, children make up 20% of the population, but they're actually 40% 40% of all victims of sexual offences. Now, something else that's happening, Zorn, which we can't ignore and we mustn't, is children are themselves becoming child sex abusers. And that is because, in part, of the internet. But it's because of toxic masculinity in the manosphere. So you get teachers, we have countless reports of teachers now, droves and droves of women teachers leaving the profession all over the world saying, I can't cope anymore. I've got boys at school mimicking, raping me, creating nudes, CSAM, downloading child sexual abuse material. It's out of control. And the fact that 840,000 men will admit that they've got a sexual interest in children, doesn't that tell you everything you need to know? That they know there's no punishment. If you look through any of the criminal justice proceedings in terms of child sexual abuse, right, at the moment, globally, you'll see that these child sexual abuse offenders, they get like 9 months to 1 year's maximum for downloading millions of images of children, babies, heinous sexual abuse acts towards children. So what message is that sending these perpetrators? It sends the message, it's fine, we're not really bothered. You can do it, get away with it, and nothing bad is going to happen to you really, because they'll be out of prison in a few months. Now, when I talk to MPs about this, because I'm an advisor to HM government, I'm an advisor to the United Nations, the WHO, and lots of other prominent governance and organisations. And when I say this to them, the response I get is, there's too many, Liz. We can't put them all in prison. Where does that leave us as women, mothers, children? Where does that leave us if child sexual abuse is so prevalent now? It's so rife that we just simply do not have the space to lock everybody up. Well, we need different solutions, don't we? And I think for me, one of the core solutions is, which people have been trying to do for years and years and years, we also have the rise in online exploitation of children. Getting children to take pictures of themselves and then blackmailing them. Goodness me, the website that was uncovered recently that I know was on CNN in the US, and it was also on Channel 4 News, about the millions of men going to the website where men are drugging their wives and raping them while they're asleep.
Okay, so for our, as we're kind of like wrapping things up, I believe, and I know you believe, that there are not really individual solutions to political problems, and we have to make a lot of systemic changes for women and children to be safe. But at the same time, I know we all have this impulse to look into, okay, but what can people as individuals do to protect themselves? So as a researcher in this area, what advice would you give women who are contemplating leaving an abuser, who are in the family courts, or who are going through the process of post-separation abuse? Is there anything that you have observed that seems to diffuse this kind of abuse, or that seems to get the courts to listen?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Personally, what I would say is, which I say to everybody who asks me, if you can keep your child to a level of safety that you do not need to go anywhere near the family courts, I would absolutely advise that. The family courts is not a place of safety or protection. It just is not. And I'm not going to lie to people and say, oh, you might be okay if you do this. Or these systems were built by men for men. They're not trauma informed, they're not abuse informed. And finding a lawyer and a gal, a guardian ad litem, or a custody evaluator, finding people who understand abuse and trauma is like looking for a needle in a haystack. That is slightly changing through training, very good training that's happening, especially via groups like National Safe Parents and Professor Joan Mayer's group at George Washington. Now, so that's my first advice. If you can stay away from the family courts, stay the hell away from them. If you have to go to the family courts, if you really feel you have to go to the family courts, be prepared with everything that I've told you today. Be prepared to be cast as a crazy, hysterical lunatic. And the way you can counter that, and this is not legal advice because I'm not a lawyer, but the way you can best counter that is to make sure there is as much of a support network around you as is humanly possible. When I say support network, having a family court case is akin to having an extra full-time job. And I've written about this on in one of my Substacks about the invisible labour of family court. It is a whole job in itself. And the reason I'm doing more research on this is because so many mums talk to me about it. So get yourself a strong support network or tap into one that exists around these groups. So peer support groups, if you can. There are lots popping up all over the place now, lots of fantastic ones. I can certainly share some with you. Tap into those support networks to allow yourself the time to rest, the time to prepare, and the time to enable you to get to a point where you can flick to whatever evidence you need, exactly when you need it, be as organized as you possibly can, record everything. Try and keep communication as minimal with an abuser as possible. Keep it direct, keep it short. Do not engage in emotional wars or you know, if you can possibly limit contact as much as you can. If you do have the money, if you have the money, get representation. But when I say representation, please, please do your research via Google or whatever means you have. Do not make the mistake of thinking every single lawyer understands abuse and understands trauma because they don't. Even if it says on their website, I'm 100% abuse informed, you want to see references. You want to speak to other people who've had this person as a lawyer. You need to be sure that this person really understands what they're doing. If you can't afford a lawyer, it might be that you go to a family court strategist. So, a super one I know is called Caitlin Jorgensen or Jorgensen, and I can send you her details. She's a family court strategist.
Yeah, I love Caitlin. I had her on the podcast
Yes.
about 2 years ago. So yeah,
Oh,
I'll post
she's
her in the show
fantastic.
notes. She's really
Brilliant.
great.
So she teaches people how to reframe statements you make when you're in court. So she makes statements less emotionally charged, and she f makes it so that the statements are more about emphasizing the perpetrator's behavior than about the harm that's done to you. Because I hate to say this, but I need to be blunt. The courts do not care about the harm caused to you as a mum. And A lot of the time, they don't care about the harm caused to the child. What they do care about is the evidence in front of them. And if you can show them, look, every time I try to make an arrangement with this person, this is what they do. So Caitlin's fantastic at that, at helping you to strategize and organize how you speak in a court, how you present in a court. Again, if you can't afford a strategist, there are new people, a wonderful woman called Jenny Lonner, who I presented with at the International Conference of Coercive Control a couple of weeks ago. Now, what she does is just organise all your paperwork for you. So if you can, if again, if you can't pay someone to do that, can you get a friend to help you with that? This is really highly charged information. It's about your child, and it's going to be extremely triggering because you're reliving all your abusive circumstances and situations every time you go and speak to a new professional or every time you go to the courtroom. So, can you get someone to help you with the paperwork, get organised? And I think the best advice I could give is just keep reminding yourself every single day what an amazing mother you are and what you've come through to get this far, and look how well your child is doing, how safe they are, and be proud of yourself, you know, because every mum that I speak to in my research studies, there's so much self-blame there. And so whenever I interview mums, I always make sure I finish the interviews by getting them to tell me about wonderful things they've done, about things that they're proud of, because there's so much for them to be proud of, Zorn. And I have to hold my hands up and say, I know a lot of what I've written at the moment is about criticizing the systems, and that's what I do. I'm a critical researcher, but I will be writing more about healing from all of this, and what mums can do to keep themselves going. But I just want every mum out there to know that you're an absolute star, and don't let these courts convince you that you're not a great mum.
I love that. That's wonderful advice, and that's a great place to leave it. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You're doing such incredible work, and I'm just grateful
Thank
to have you out
you.
in the world.
Thank you so much. And your work is amazing, Zorn. And that it's actually been such a huge honor for me. I'm so grateful to be here. So thank you so much.
Well, it's just been wonderful. And thank you again, listeners. I will be back next week and I will put all of Elizabeth's information in the show notes. So please check her out, check out her Substack, and you'll hear from me again soon.